Вас вітає Брисбен, і з вами Анна Головченко із останніми новинами нашого штату. Так, 20 листопада у приміщенні Української католицької церкви відбулася цікава зустріч нашої ком'юніті із доктором Філіпом Карбером, який протягом 2014 та 2016 років на прохання українського уряду провів 25 візитів до зон бойових дій в Україні. Він пробув 177 днів в бойових підрозділах на лінії фронту і провів співбесіди із їх командувачами. Результат своєї роботи Філіп Кабе представив на закритій сесії Комітету Озброєних сил Конгресу США і є великим прихильником збільшення військової допомоги України. Доктор Кабе є експертом Сполучених Штатів із питань національної та інтернаціональної безпеки і має глибокі знання військової справи. Його послужний список налічує багато визначних посад. Так, він служив радником прем'єр-міністра Великобританії Маргарет Тетчер та генерального секретаря НАТО Манфред Боне. На нашій зустрічі пан Кабе провів досить емоційну презентацію на тему «Мої враження від війни на сході України. Можливі глобальні наслідки». Пропонуємо вашій увазі моє інтерв'ю із доктором Карбером, що ми записали для вас після закінчення презентації. So, dear listeners, please welcome Dr. Kaba here. He just came back from Ukraine in October, and now we're in the end of November, and we're very happy to have a chance to talk to a person who spent 33 months at Ukraine and spent about 25 trips. Did you have
25 trips and 177 days at the front with the troops?
My first question: how actually you started this mission? What initial objectives, and who actually invited you to Ukraine, and what initial reason was there? And if you can tell me some, you know, milestones of your journey, how it progressed, how you came to 33 months spent at Ukraine.
The foundation which I'm president of, which is the Potomac Foundation, which is nonprofit and nonpartisan, does research on national and international security issues. I'd helped start it, but then I was off doing other things until recently, 4 or 5 years ago, I was came back as president. In between the Potomac Foundation starting in 1988 and my return, they had ran over 1,000 training sessions for former Soviet republics and Warsaw Pact members that wanted to reform their military or consider being part of NATO. Several Ukrainians had attended those sessions. And when the crisis started and the interim government came in after Yanukovych fled, several of those members had been attended those sessions. And so they contacted us and asked if we would do a training session for some of the new members of the interim government, senior members, and also some of their senior military. And so we said, sure, we'd be happy to do it. And they were going to bring a team of about a dozen over to Washington. We were going to spend 3 weeks training them. As events started unfolding in the Donbass, that sent a message and said, we can't make it. We can't come because we can't pull our senior people out in the middle of a conflict. Would you be willing to come over and help us assess this, the situation? So I reached out to an old friend of mine, General Wesley Clark, who was a Supreme Allied Commander of NATO and a 2004 Democratic presidential candidate. And I said, hey, would you want to join me? All of our activity, I've never received a penny from anybody in Ukraine. All the activity that we've done up to about a year ago was all funded by this foundation. So General Clark, all my trips, translators, everything came at our expense. And that's what our board, our foundation does things like that that we think are important. So we've done that in other countries or helped other countries around the world. So that wasn't unusual. So General Clark and I were there, and he realized that he made the point, the situation is going to deteriorate. We need to find out what's going on at the front. And at the time, the United States and Western countries stopped their attachés and their intelligence people from going east of the Dnieper. There was actually a ban on them because they didn't want them to get kidnapped or assassinated. So put together a team, and I started going to the front. First trip, I thought it was going to be the only trip. And came back to Washington. and people were very interested. And we started, General Clark and I began, the Congress asked us to give some reports, and we started arguing for aid to Ukraine. We thought it was necessary. That created considerable debate in Washington, and our first report hit the front page of the New York Times, and it created a lot of stir. This is the spring of 2014. Administration was still very reluctant, so and we had a lot of questions. So I returned to answer some of those questions, and each time I came back, I got to know more commanders, more people at the front, and became more and more impressed with the importance of Ukraine to the West. I thought the mission of creating a free and independent Ukraine was really important. The more I met volunteers, young officers, and particularly this new generation of combat commanders, the more impressed I was. One of the eight commanders at the front that I interviewed in that first year, brigade commanders, there wasn't one of them. They were all different, by the way, no kind of stereotype. But there wasn't one of them I wouldn't have felt comfortable serving under, or having one of my boys serve under. I was honestly impressed, and not just with what they said, but in witnessing their combat actions and the way they organized their troops. So as things developed, the issue became clearer, and so in the summer of 2014, Congress asked General Clark and I to give them a report, a closed session of the House Armed Services Committee. And we briefed them on Ukraine, and we argued that Ukraine needed five major items of American equipment. Eventually, it took a little much longer than we ever hoped, but eventually four of those came to Ukraine. That included radios that the Russians couldn't jam, unmanned aerial vehicle, counter-battery radar, so the Ukrainians could see where the Russians were firing from, and light mobile vehicles. Some of these worked out well. Ukraine is very happy with the counter-battery radar that they finally got. They love the radios and the unmanned aerial vehicles. The mobility vehicles, we sent them basically a bunch of junk, and it was embarrassing. The only lethal weapon we recommended was the anti-tank weapon Javelin, or a system similar called TOW-2. We are General Clark, and the Ukrainian people have to know this. He basically sacrificed his political relationship with the Obama administration to the point where they basically stopped talking to him because he kept pushing and pushing and pushing. No, we just thought it was the right thing to do. About a year ago, the U.S. military started realizing that what was happening in eastern Ukraine was relevant to the defense of the rest of NATO, and our own forces needed to learn important lessons from it. The result of that, that's the first time that somebody then started also helping pay for the trips, and so I would go there and have since brought Ukrainian officers, combat commanders, out to NATO countries and to the U.S., introduce them and have them brief and help our troops understand the combat conditions. And I must say, American and NATO audiences are impressed with them as I was. On this last trip, I brought General Breedlove, former Supreme Allied Commander, and he said he thought it were the Ukrainian airborne troops in Zhytomyr. And we watched him do the exercises, and he goes, I think these are as good as the best in NATO. So over time, the first year and a half was trying to get as much help for Ukraine as possible. And then the last year has been trying to help our military understand the cause. And by the way, every American general or senior officer that I've either brought, I brought the first American general who was allowed to go to the front. Everyone who's been with Ukrainians and met them, particularly at the front, come away going, you know, we ought to be supporting them. They ought to be in NATO. NATO needs them as much as Ukraine needs NATO, and we ought to be supporting that.
Thank you so much. Very inspiring. I can kind of see the three steps of this journey. That's based on, it started from research, basic research, your reports back to Congress. Then they wanted something more. Then it's turned into lesson learned exercise and some input to NATO. So because each war is different and each war brings something new to political maps and something new each time we need to know and we need to learn and probably exchange this knowledge. So it's very good. But even located here so far in Australia, we can clearly see that after first couple months, each part of the world were caring about Ukraine, really wanted to help. All faces turned and looked what happened. But each month, because nothing were happening in resolving the conflict, and it's kind of everyone to try to be comfortable in their positions and hold their grounds and don't go into any actions. So Russia took Crimea, as we know. They took a major part of East. And it's kind of now it's in the gray area. So it's not that so active, but it means for the rest of universe that it's harder for us Ukrainians to bring their attention. Do you see something in the nearest future what can resolve this conflict, and what kind of your personal opinion will can help Ukrainians resolve this situation?
This is my personal opinion. I make no claim that any U.S. administration, let alone the new one, will follow it. But I think a very clear message. By the way, Ukraine is off the front pages, is off the 10th pages of newspapers. People aren't paying attention. But the violence continues. It was August. It was the third highest, most violent month in the entire war. There are new Russian forces, an entire tank army sitting to the northeast of Chernigov and Sumy. New divisions have been arriving opposite Kharkiv. The Russians are reinforcing Crimea. They just ran a huge exercise, basically simulating the with actual forces, the amphibious invasion of Odessa and the Sea of Azov. Literally tonight, they're doing a big exercise with their 20th Army just opposite to the Donbas. So they haven't been passive, and the firing and the violence continues, and there's kids being wounded and killed every day, even though we in the West don't recognize it or don't pay much attention to it. The war has stabilized in the sense that both sides have dug in. It doesn't move a lot, unlike the first year where you would get these major thrusts one way or the other. But that doesn't mean that the violence doesn't continue. So to address your question, how do you end this? I don't think Ukraine can. But the United States is a signatory to the Budapest Agreement, by which Ukraine gave up access to nuclear weapons. If we ever have a hope of putting a ceiling on the number of countries that have nuclear weapons, we have to enforce the Budapest Agreement. Because everybody else can go, hey, look at Ukraine. They gave them up, and look what happened to them. So Obama says he wants to get rid of nuclear weapons, and it was the worst thing that could be done to his policy of getting rid of nuclear weapons was not enforcing the Budapest Agreement. So how do you enforce it? Well, first of all, I think the war in Ukraine is too important to be left to German and French politicians, their own agendas. While they promote the Minsk Agreement, the Minsk ceasefires are not well enforced. The OSCE has only 10% of the people necessary to actually observe their whole sections in the Donbas where they're forbidden or where they have to announce ahead of time. So the inspection regime is too little and too impotent. And even when they find violations, the OSCE has documented that the Russians are starting 70% of the fighting consistently since the Minsk II ceasefire. And we all know the amount of Russian equipment. I mean, there are two entire corps, army corps, with Russian generals in charge in the Donbas, and a third one right across the border being formed near Rostov. This is not fiction. This is we know it exists. I can name you the top 20 or 30 Russian generals who are running the whole Donbas operation. Yeah, there's most of the fighting's done by separatists or mercenaries or Russian volunteers, but who's commanding? It's regular Russian officers. We know that. They know that. Step number one, the United States, as a signatory, and preferably doing it in concert with Britain, who's also a signatory of the Budapest Agreement, needs to tell Russia, stop the violence, or we will decisively arm Ukraine. You want to send weapons in? The Russians have sent 1,000 tanks, have sent and armored vehicles, hundreds and hundreds of heavy artillery. We haven't seen not a single lethal weapon's come from the West. The most effective sanction of this war is not what's being done on the economics to Russia, but a virtual complete embargo on any lethal aid to Ukraine. First step is Russia. It's your officers there. It's your military structure. We know it. You know it. You can play all the little games you want with green men and between us, eyeball to eyeball, we know it and you know it. Get them out. Stop the violence. Or we will arm Ukraine. And we're not going to just send some anti-tank missiles. We're going to, Ukrainian Air Force could use, we have literally thousands of American tanks sitting in storage because our army is a lot smaller. Hundreds of modern fighter aircraft sitting in storage. And I'm sure that within a few months, the Ukrainians could learn to operate and use those. So you want to play this game? We'll play it. So that would be my first comment. If they don't follow through with it, then I think the second thing is to actually implement them. The United States, you cannot run NATO from behind. This idea that this has become popular, we'll lead from behind. It's not leadership, it's followership. There's really sort of three NATOs. There's Southern Europe, which is caught up in economic crisis and refugee crisis. There's old Western Europe, which are still living under the illusion that they can they can get Russian energy in exchange. They'll help modernize and sell their products to Russia. And then there's Eastern Europe, which, along with Ukraine, is being threatened almost on a daily basis. The Baltics, the Finns and Swedes, who stayed neutral through the Cold War, now talking about joining NATO. The Poles, these people understand the threat posed. So that part of the alliance needs leadership, and that's what the United States should be providing that alliance. And as part of that, we ought to be integrating that group of NATO with Ukraine. Now, if the rest of NATO doesn't want it, okay, we can create the Eastern Alliance. I would like to try to do it in a NATO framework, but if somebody wants to veto it, having the rest of the crowd is nice window dressing, but militarily it doesn't matter. What matters is people who want to defend themselves, who are willing to fight for freedom, and willing to organize themselves in a common structure, and the United States can provide that leadership. So I think that's the second thing we should do. Third, we need to start playing proactive politics. So you look at, Belarus, for example. It's been isolated because Lukashenko is obviously a dictator. They're authoritarian. Western Europe doesn't like to deal with him. But he threw out a bunch of the Russians. And when Putin wanted to stage forces in Belarus, he said no, much to Putin's public anger. He's tried to provide a venue in Minsk. I mean, he's not responsible for the Minsk agreement, but he tried to serve to get the war stopped. He said that the Belarusians would not invade any other country. Well, if the Russians can't go into Belarus, they really don't threaten Poland. They don't threaten the Baltics. And so I think we ought to be working hard to try to help Belarus be part of this defense area that runs from the Baltic through Poland, Belarus, and Ukraine into the Black Sea. That's a natural alliance. It's probably a long-term objective. But those are the three things that I would recommend.
Thank you. So we talk about two things, like what happened, how you took your Ukrainian journey, so your view on current situation and what can be changed and what can be done. And my third question before, I will thank you so much for such a good night and wonderful presentation what we had today. I want to ask about you personally. You from Washington, here in Australia and Brisbane, what your next steps will be? Will you continue with Ukraine? Will you go have a look at Syria, or will you do something else? Will you do some academical research? Because you are a human being, and we are not only talking about Ukraine and allies and about our relationship with America. And I even wouldn't ask you a question, but what you as a researcher, as a person who were in academic for long time, but at the same time you are hands-on professional, what are your future plans for closest time?
A Freudian question, right? But I have sort of a split personality. On the one hand, I like to study and do research and reflect. And on the other hand, I believe in being a person of action. And when you see a cause or you see an issue that's important, not merely talking about it, but getting involved in it. So prior to Ukraine, when the Chinese were building up in the South China Sea, in fact, my last trip to Australia 3 years ago, I actually had dinner with your Joint Chiefs. I was reporting on my going around assessing the military situation in the South China Sea and throughout the Philippines and Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Borneo. So I like going out in the field and doing that stuff. At one point, I was invited to go into Syria, but when I arrived in Istanbul to link up with to go in and visit the Syrian free opposition, all the people who were going to take me in had been killed in an ambush. So I never made it to Syria, and I'll probably leave that one to another day. There's something special about Ukraine. I was adopted from an orphanage by an elderly couple who had German background, but their family had been a part of the German farmers in the that had been invited into southern Russia. So my mother, for example, made Veronica and Borscht. At the time I didn't even realize that was particularly Ukrainian. But without being too personal or emotional, I honestly have fell in love with the country. I like the people. I feel at home there. And so many people at the front, some of whom are no longer with us. And I carry every one of those faces in my heart. Whatever I do next, I don't believe it won't be without remaining very involved in trying to help Ukraine. I don't like getting involved in the domestic politics. Hard enough understanding with the military situation. But I firmly believe that we need to help Ukraine out of our own strategic interest. And if Ukraine wants to join the West and particularly be in a military alliance with the West, we ought to be doing everything possible to help and assist in that. And if Ukraine doesn't want to do that, it's fine with me too. But I think they have the right to choose, and that decision cannot and should not be made in Moscow. It needs to be made by the Ukrainian people. One of the questions I'm usually asked when I come back talking to an American audience, and because the United States has tried to help people around the world, some of them, frankly, aren't all that grateful, you know, particularly in the Middle East. And people turn to me and say, do the Ukrainians want to be like us? And I think about it for a second and go, no, they are us. When I'm going through the wheat fields or the sunflower fields of southern Ukraine, I feel like I'm in Ohio or Kansas. When I'm in the mountains and the Carpathians, I feel like I'm at home in California Sierras. When I'm in the coast, Mariupol, I feel like could be at a beach in Florida. I think I've seldom been in a country where I feel like the people themselves, the spirit and culture that is so similar to the America that I grew up in. So I feel at home there. That's become the great love of my life. I just turned 70 a couple months ago. 5 kids, 8 grandkids, and the kids were searching me and say, "Hey, Dad, you know what's the deal with you in Ukraine?" I go, "The last 33 months, or 25 trips, other than the birth of you guys, of course, but have been the best years of my life. I don't regret them. It's not what I've tried. It's not what I've done for Ukraine. It's what Ukraine has done for me. It really is the great love of my life."
Thank you so much, and I want to thank you deeply for all your time and for all your kind words, what you just said to us about Ukrainians, and that Ukrainians are nation, what part of your heart right now. I want to wish you from all of us all encouragement and support, not only from US, but also from us Ukrainians, because we can be sometimes quite stubborn and don't listen and be not cooperative. And I hope that with your help, some people will find something in their heart as well, and it will bring a lot of good things for Ukrainian and Ukrainian friendship together.
One last thought. I remember a Ukrainian commander who had been brought in during a mobilization reserves, a businessman in normal life. And he turned to me and said, "You know, Putin has done what Ukraine couldn't do for ourselves. He's turned us from a state into a nation." And I think that's really true. So best of luck.
Thank you so much. And for all our listeners, з вами була Аня Головченко спеціально для SBS.